You are listening to We the People Radio again.
Once again. We're back.
And so it's fun. We have substitute hosts next week. They're going to be talking about some local issues and some recall information. And I think you guys will like it. We've got to go hang out with the Kubota Tractor folks. So
yeah, we're going to be down in Phoenix enjoying a little warm weather. We haven't had enough of it.
That's a lie. We're not going to be enjoying it at all. It's horrible.
No, it's not.
I wanted to go to like Nashville or Atlanta.
That would have been nice.
I know. I wanted to go somewhere fun. Anyway.
There's nothing wrong with the kidnapping capital of the world.
I know. And it's hot. Did I mention that? It's going to be hot again.
Yeah.
So anyway, my name is Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
And I'm Bob Martin.
Yeah, we should get that out of the way before I forget. And you can find all of our information, past shows, information about today's show, archives. We've got a ton of archives. And we do archive them commercial free. We do like to honor capitalism during the program, but then we get rid of the capitalism for you after the fact. All the music's still in there, though, and that's obviously worth listening to twice. So you can find that all at wethepeopleradio.us. We've got two different things going on today. We will have Chuck Floyd, who is the Chief Executive Officer, and Bruce Moran, who's the National Security Advisor for Security Solutions Technologies. We've had Bruce on more times than Chuck, but we have had Chuck on before, and I'll link those past shows. Easier for me to say. Security Solutions Technology, there we go, is a veteran-owned company that provides federal government consulting, IT professional services, and security assessments. They do cybersecurity, geospatial, program and lifecycle management, change management, logistics, and financial consulting. Some of those things, I don't even know what that means. But they provide performance
it's
and results-based.
That's all you need to know.
Well, the important part is they provide a performance and results-based culture.
There you are.
Ah, go figure that out.
Uh-huh.
That's
results.
That's probably super confusing for the government.
They're still in the planning stages.
So we're going to catch up on like border wall, national security, all that good stuff. So we had a little scramble here at the first, but do we have everybody on?
This is Chuck. I'm here.
Hiya, Chuck.
Hello, Chuck.
Thanks for coming back.
Oh, no problem. It's a pleasure. We really need to talk about border security and what President Trump's trying to do and what Mitch McConnell and several Republicans and Democrats are trying not for him to do.
Yes. Let's get to the bottom of that. What's real and what's not? Because obviously most of what we hear, you know, on network news and all that is, if we don't know it's made up at the time, we find out later it was fictional.
I think we all want to believe they're going to build a wall. Tell me it's true.
Well, I have no faith in Mitch McConnell getting anything done. You know, to me, he's been the worst Senate leader in the history of our republic. We've written articles about him, and I don't know why. Trump's supposed to have a meeting with him tomorrow and read him the riot act and say, hey, Mitch, get on board or get out. So hopefully he's going to start getting on board. We have hundreds and probably up to 1,000 political appointees, myself, many others, who are ready to go serve and support the president. We can't get in because the Senate won't vote on the undersecretaries, and I talked to Ted Cruz last week, and they have 160, I believe it was, judicial nominees that can't get a vote. And so, Mitch McConnell, what are you doing? Where are you?
Now, is that unusual for it to take this long when a new president comes in to have...
No, it is not. I was on the Bush transition team, then I went to work for Bush as a presidential appointee at State Department, which I hope to do, go back under Trump and help him at State Department also. But that is not normal. When I was at the transition team, we were vetting people to go into the administration, and within 6 to 9 months, we had thousands of people in. And then, because what you have to do is get your secretaries, and you have to get your undersecretaries, and then so all the people that have to be approved by the Senate have to go through the confirmation and then the voting. That's key. Then once they get into the different agencies, then they can then bring in their people that do not have to go in front of the Senate, and that moves very quickly. And so most of the senior appointees have been identified. They're ready to go. But the Senate for some reason, it's just not doing anything. For an example, I attended a hearing over a month ago for Eric Ulan, who is supposed to be the Undersecretary of Management at the State Department. They still haven't voted on him. You look at the deputy for OMB. That was over 2 months ago, and they still haven't voted on that person. So, Mitch McConnell, wake up, do your job.
So is this because, I mean, what a lot of people are hearing is, well, the Democrats are blocking everything.
But that's legislation.
That's legislation.
They can have a bare majority now.
Well,
right?
The Democrats, if Mitch McConnell would do his job, and if he has to change a rule, he change a rule. But there have been Republicans that have been in opposition. You know, the hearing I went to for Eric Ulan, Corker was the chairman. And now Corker is in a dispute with Trump and going back and forth. And so he's not getting anything done. And so Republicans are to blame along with the Democrats. And Mitch McConnell has to do his job and get things moving.
Hmm. Yeah. And then we're not even going to go on the John McCain trail.
I know it.
God, it's like, don't get us started.
That's a whole another half-hour subject of ACA and various sundry things that we talk about.
Hi, Bert.
As we're looking at border security, Chuck has been working on that. I don't know. We've been working on it for 12, 14 years. It's called Secure America's Borders Act, which helped President Trump get started. Gave him his legs. He didn't have to have legislation passed for the border. So it's called the Secure America's Borders Act. Chuck was the main principal in that with Senator Frisk, and I was involved with that to get it off the ground. What we're looking at is how and when and where will this get going, and Chuck submitted several plans, but we can talk generally about the what it's going to do, how it's going to be best suited to help protect the borders. Chuck, you want to weigh in on the beginning of that, and I'll weigh in during the middle?
Yeah, absolutely. We have been giving the Trump administration, even before Trump started running, I was working with him, and I gave him a lot of information on the border security plan, on the immigration plan, and everything you see in the 70-point plan, we provided information for. And then Heritage Foundation, Judicial Watch, FAIR, a lot of other organizations have also moved in. So if this is Trump going natural as far as deal making. And so if you go back and look a few weeks ago when he brought Nancy and Chuck Schumer in and talked to them about DACA and what they would do and whatever, and then they went and go, hey, we got a deal. Well, you really don't have a deal. And so now Trump is the deal maker, where he has put the Democrats on pure defensive for DACA. And so if Trump does not get funding for the wall, if he doesn't get the immigration pass like he did in his recent 70-point plan, no DACA whatsoever. And so, the carrot and the stick. And so right now, the Democrats are saying, hey, we're not going to work with you on anything. And if you look at what happened with Nancy Pelosi, her people out in San Francisco just berated her and forced her to just leave the meeting that she had.
Yeah, that was fun.
It was. And so Trump is setting everything up. He's the deal maker. And so he's setting it up where he will get funding for the wall. He doesn't need to really do a whole lot with Congress and have them authorize a whole lot of money for the wall. He's got plenty of money in the DHS budget to start the wall, to get things rolling. If you go back and look at what Obama did, he diverted DHS funding from ICE, from CBP, Coast Guard, and all the other agencies at DHS to accept all these DACA kids and families and then fly them all over the U.S. And we provide all of the social things, from food stamps and phones and all these other things, and all that came out of the DHS funding and was never authorized. And so I've sent in information to the administration where you can build a wall. You can start it right away. But Trump is the deal maker. He is the expert at it, and he's putting pressure on the Democrats and the liberal Republicans right now in order to get this accomplished.
Yes, and we're trying to look at the rules and regs as they relate to, as you know, it's been in the new sanctuary cities, and that's DACA and criminal activity. One of the things Chuck and I had reiterated earlier is that what's really not being expressed is the inhumane treatment of people coming across the border, the rapes, the sick kids sold as sex slaves, all the stuff that the media is not addressing, we always address because that's part and parcel to what needs to be done to protect the human rights of people. It's basically how do you protect the human rights of people. And first of all, we're trying to protect the U.S. citizens. And part of the border security and the refugee crisis is to identify who can be problems in the United States. As you know, we added on three more countries. And the Supreme Court ruled in our favor just a week ago. So they knocked out. I think there's one left from Hawaii that he had objection to the refugee situation. Now we're clear and free on that. Now we're moving towards understanding how to get a better handle on counterterrorism, on the terrorist activity in the United States, and how to deal with closing the borders down to protect U.S. citizens, and how the U.S. citizens can best be prepared to handle a crisis. And now you're handling crisis with the hurricanes, with the wildfires,
right.
And now we have all these other, sundry things that are going on. They're taking monies away from the budget. But the budget is appropriated, like Chuck was saying, to handle a border to be built.
All right, hang on, fellas. We've got to take a quick break. And as we head to that break, I'm going to post this news article. But there's one of the DACA people, people always say, oh, they're the best citizens we have. They contribute, blah, blah, blah. Except for one of them is with a nice tattoo on his neck, always attractive. He's a 19-year-old accused of murder, kidnapping, and possession of a weapon during a violent crime in connection with the death of 18-year-old Diana Martinez-Gonzalez in South Carolina.
That's
she
right.
was a high school student.
That's right.
So there we go. For all those people that have heard DACA recipients have a zero crime rate.
Well, MS-13 recruits from DACA, too.
Right. Well, I can tell you, yeah. So there's at least one that's a bad guy as of today. We'll be right back Chuck and with Bruce.
Okay.
Putting your hands in your head.
Yeah.
So nice and set of handcuffs.
Whoever came up with a dreamer.
It's like handcuff you.
I know.
They need to be deported.
Feels like we're not ever using the word dreamer. Then out comes the song, Chase Louise.
Yeah.
All right, boys.
It's inculcated into the culture now, those ideas that they want to present to minimize, the culture, to minimize the effect of, the Constitution and various sundry things that go along with it. I would say even the national anthem and the flag. So even see that happening in our football stadiums and the basketball court.
Well, don't forget the part about how anybody who raises any questions about this, like the fact that this guy actually held another girl captive. I read further in the article. He held another girl captive, and she was the one who turned him in. So I think this is a pretty solid case. And yet, just the fact that we're talking about it makes us haters. So it's ridiculous.
Just recently in Montgomery County, Maryland, right outside of D.C., we had two DACA high school kids rape a 13-year-old girl at school.
My gosh.
Again, when the Democrats saying they need to protect the children and all this, a lot of these young adults were present by their families by themselves, and so they are young men and older, and so and again, a lot of them are joining gangs and just causing havoc. Northern Virginia, the crime has gone up drastically. But if you look at Trump's 70-point immigration policy priorities, there are three different areas. One is border security, one is interior enforcement, and one is merit-based immigration system. And so he's told the Democrats and the Republicans, I want those three things first, and guess what? DACA is now fourth. And so
President Trump
is the deal maker, and so he's putting this together where this thing is going to fall in place, forcing the border security and interior enforcement, the merit-based immigration, or the comprehensive plan prior to anything for DACA. And if you look at his border security plan, the second point, which I would like to talk about, is that the Department of Homeland Security can raise and collect fees from visa services and border crossings to fund border security and enforcement activities. Guess what? That tells me Mexico is paying for the wall.
Oh. That's good. That's a good thing.
Absolutely.
So how the 70-point plan that he is proposing, how is that going over in the Senate? I mean, I don't think it's going to have a problem in the House, but what's the prognosis in the Senate, do you think?
Well, I think it's going to have a tough time in the Senate because of the Rhino Republicans. And you look at McCain and all the rest of the individuals that say, oh, we have to have bipartisanship. Well, guess what? When Obama was president, there wasn't any bipartisanship. Everything was forced down our throat.
But so, the thing is, if McCain votes for it, we do have bipartisanship because he's not really actually a Republican.
That's a good point. And so what I've suggested to the White House and to the administration is that President Trump needs to get out on the stump more, and every 2 weeks he needs to give the American people a fireside chat as what's going on, who's doing what, and name names in the Senate for people to call and say, this senator is not doing his or her job. Let's go after that senator, and this is what we need to do. So the White House really has to step up their PR game in order to make sure that the president is supported by the Republican Party. If the Republican Party supported him on this immigration and border security, along with Obamacare, along with the debt ceiling, along with the tax plan, the Iran negotiation, the Republicans would be in majority for 50 years because this is what the American people want. And
this is what our country is based upon.
Like McConnell,
this is how we grew up and how people become economically free to do what they to raise their families. This is not anything unusual that President Trump is introducing. He's just bringing us back to our roots in what I guess we can say the Heritage Foundation, because we can talk about Ed Foner and Ed Misu help us out, are great behind backing this kind of program because this is the traditional American family. This is who we are and what we've done and what's been successful. What hasn't been successful are the programs that have been out there for 20, 30 years that have been given to people and they entitle them to things. And it takes away from the structure of the economy. It takes away from the economy growing. It doesn't create jobs.
But
and that's, the basic foundation of how we grew up and what we believe in our work ethic.
But isn't that really the basis of the Democrats' angst is you can't take all this away. These people have had it for so long. You can't take it away from them now.
They're Americans.
They deserve it.
They don't know anything about their country. They grew up here.
Yeah, how do you counter that? Because they always go back to that.
It's like, I've been living in your house since you went away on vacation. You can't come back in.
Yeah, that's right.
I deserve it.
Well, the same attitude, the people that come into the country from the South on the border, from the South American countries to Mexico, think they're entitled to things, too.
Yeah.
And that's what the refugees do. They, once they get here, they're entitled to things. No, that's not what American citizenry is about. It's about to contribute to your society and to become part of society and assimilate. The most important question that should be asked is assimilation. What do you want to do to be part of our society and to contribute to our society? It's not to get the handouts and just to live and to, you know, do what you did in your other country. There's nothing wrong with that, you know what I'm saying? But on the other hand, you got to be part of society and, you know, help out. Make sure you're working, make sure you're raising your kids and, you know, they're going to school, they're not becoming criminals, they're, you know, taking part in the entire structure. What I'm talking about is they're working in community organizations and voicing their opinions. Now, we're talking about so many different things here. I want to get back to maybe something on the national security front that just came across the view this week, which was Iran.
Bruce, let me make one more point on the border plan, and then we get into Iran. You know, the third item that President Trump said in his 70-point immigration plan is merit-based immigration system, where we end family chain migration and we end the green cards and all the other access of individuals coming into our country, and we force them and their employers to be totally responsible for them, where they receive no social benefits. And so we have to really get a handle on the social benefits in this country. I'm going to give you an example here in Florida. After the hurricane, DHS was giving out, I think it was like $900 and some per person for food and different things, which is fine. But again, a lot of people didn't need it. And so they just said, hey, government's giving away. I'm going to go standing line. I'm going to get my card and get free meals, you know, $900 and some. And so I'm going, yeah, wow. You know, how do we do this? You know, how do you qualify people for this, these sort of things? It's just unbelievable. And it's just giving money out and there's nothing in return.
Well, if you're going to give it away to citizens. You know, this giving it away to anybody that wants to knock on the door and come in,
preference to citizens. I mean,
yeah, that's what I mean.
If you look at education, and we bring this up all the time because I hear this from coworkers, they have kids applying to college, but because their parents went to college, so they check that box, they're not a minority, they're just, you know, they don't make a lot of money. They don't have cable TV. They don't have enough money for that, but they have more than, you know, somebody who's living on welfare, so they're entitled to zip while these other guys get a free ride, and they're not even citizens of the country.
That is true. I mean, it's unbelievable how the Democrats have changed the rules that we go by because they want new voters. That's the only reason.
No, you're absolutely right. But if you look at, you know, they say, oh, well, the, you know, the U.S. level of poverty is so much higher than anywhere else in the world.
How many people in poverty have cell phones in 80?
Exactly. But I'll also say, if you want to go, you know, into the deep south, I mean, there's a lot of places in the country where you have true poverty. I mean, kids that, you know, don't get enough to eat, don't have clothes. I mean, there's plenty of places to have programs like that for people that are, you know, citizens. I just,
saying, we're not a failed state, a third world country, a developing country. We have all the benefits of a middle class that are given to our people we consider poor.
Right.
And when I travel abroad, I'm amazed at what people think of what poor is. You know, our poor here are, you know, would be middle class, you know.
Oh, sure.
Some places else.
Sure. No, I agree.
One of the things
I like about Trump's plan is with the Interior Enforcement, they're going to force everybody to use e-verbal.
That's exactly what I was just going to say.
It's an option.
Yes.
Everybody is going to be forced to use it, and so. And then, so one, the other thing is that we're in the plan, they can go after employers who employ illegals. And what I'd like, also like to see is that the Justice Department should be able to go after the politicians that do not abide by the law.
Yeah, totally agree.
Let's
face it, E-Verify would completely just hammer that down. It'd make all the rest of it just so much cleaner. We've got to take a really quick break again, and we're going to come back. And then national security? No, we're talking, Iran. Is that our next stop, fellas? I can't believe you're only on here for an hour. We already don't have enough time. It's not even done yet. We'll be back with Bruce and with Chuck Floyd here and chat about Iran a little bit. You can find us online at wethepeopleradio.us.
To Fernando.
Referring to the House of Representatives.
Yes, exactly. We've got to give the Senate away. We need to give them to somebody who can whip them into shape. All right, so what do you guys have for us on Iran?
Okay, Bruce, you want to go in and talk about Iran, and then I'll chime in after what you say.
Sure. The Iran deal goes back many years, if you recall. Do you recall President Jimmy Carter? Operation Eagle Claw. We went to rescue the hostages.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
And who became famous during that time every night?
Ted Koppel.
Yeah, Ted Koppel.
Oh, very good.
And nice call, Bob.
365 Iran hostage crisis, ABC News Nightline.
That's right.
It's finally done in series. You know, Ted Koppel.
Every night.
Really did, brought him into fame, but also gave us a handle on how to see what's going on. What happened in Operation Eagle Claw is that the transport was there that transported the helicopters, and one of the helicopters crashed into transport, killing 8 servicemen. So we had a problem. Some of the dust storms were, when they come in, the sandstorms were up to knee deep. So you couldn't get things off the ground. The dust would get into, and the sand would get into the, you know, props. Some of the blades broke, and so they just canceled that. So subsequent to that time, we basically took the money from Iran. It came to about $12 billion. And that's what they had with the deal that is today, 28 years later. And how was that deal handled? Who handled it? And you heard about the cash going over to Iran. You know, that
right.
was...
pallets.
Drug cartel you know. Style.
Yeah, it's 400, you know... million dollars.
And
$1.5 billion.
You can't send the cash. Yeah. Why can't you send the cash? Because Congress says you can't send the cash. So they converted it into euros. And then they dropped it off in Iran. So they circumvented Congress. You know, you can't exchange hostages for cash. So they did that. And then they're also doing the deal at the same time for what? The ballistic missiles. So all that was going down at the same time. And who was the head of the Senate committee at the time? Who was the chair?
Ooh, Bob, you got that one? I was busy registering as a Republican at that time.
Are we talking 1979 here?
No. And during the Obama administration.
No. Oh!
It was Bob Corker.
Oh, yeah.
And what happened during that time? And the Republicans really upset with him. He changed to pass the law to get them the sanctions and went down to get the deal done and went down to 50 instead of the 60.
Mm.
That's when he started taking flack. So if you see flak coming back from President Trump to Corker, it could be about the original Rand deal.
I heard somewhere the other day somebody was saying he changed it so it only needed like a 36 vote approval.
Whatever happened, Corker changed the rules and it gave the president the go-ahead to do the Iran deal in the four or five faceted way he had it done.
Now, why would Corker do that?
Oh, I have no idea.
I mean,
whatever the deals were and his idea about, he's head of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and what they were doing with the Democrats and how what was being done through negotiations and strategies and how they thought ballistic missiles would be part of that program and there'd be proper inspections. And as we know from 1979 on, what has grown in power and strength? Iran.
Iran. And all the bad guys that they've been supporting. Sure.
If we had this deal done, 28 years later, well, it goes back 2 years, so that's 25 years, 26 years later, what has changed? That was President Trump's main argument. Nothing has changed. We got to change the way business is being done on our foreign policy and our national security. This deal was a bad deal. That's what he's saying. So you can see what I'm saying is what he's saying, but he understood it. That was part of his platform when he's running for the presidency.
So do they have any grounds? I mean, if they do throw this deal out, does Iran really have, they're saying that they're going to, rain terror and all that. They already are. So, is there really anything?
What happens is every 90 days it goes back into reconsideration by the Senate.
Mm-hmm.
So what the Senate can do is maybe impose more sanctions or reintroduce what they feel is necessary to have proper and fitting national security for the United States.
But there isn't anything Iran can really do, over and above what they're already doing, is there?
No, No. It's what we can do, and what inspections can be done on the ground that aren't being done. That's
right.
What I'm saying.
Okay.
Here's an example.
Chuck's trying to get a word in, but your voice is soft, Chuck.
They're developing ballistic
missiles. He's not hearing you.
Okay. And we also see them being shot over Japan. But to the degree we know where they're at, are we allowed unfettered access? The answer is no.
Okay, Chuck. Chuck, go ahead.
If you go back to where Obama came in, the first day he was in office, Valerie Jarrett, who is Iranian, started talking to the Iranians behind the scenes to put this deal together. And if you look at when Obama gave Iran the $1.5 billion in cash, which is illegal in the United States because we track all funding across the world for terror organizations. When he gave them that money, what happened in North Korea? North Korea started doing test after test after test. And so North Korea and Iran are working together, and whatever technology they find in North Korea and update, they're doing this, they're giving all that stuff to Iran. So that $1.5 billion and other billions of dollars that Obama has given Iran is funding North Korea, it's funding Iran, it's funding Hezbollah, and it's going to tear up the Middle East. This morning, General McMaster was on Fox News talking about Iran and what Trump is doing. And so he says that President Trump understands the strategic plan of the Iranian deal, where most people only look at it as a tactical plan. And so President Trump has now indicated that he's not going to go along with it because it's the worst deal ever, because they even do self-inspection. We don't even go in there. The IAEA doesn't even go in there. And so the master said this morning that what they want to do is go have Congress do their job again, just like health care, just like taxes. President Trump is for saying that he's going to decertify. He's pushed this back to Congress and told them they have 60 days to work on this thing. And so, again, what is Mitch McConnell going to do? They have to do something or it's going to be decertified, which it should be because it's illegal and it was never agreed to by the Congress.
But they've already got the money, so there's really not much we can do on that front, is there?
No, not really. The only thing we can do, which I doubt they even kept the serial numbers of the bills so they couldn't be tracked, because they, right now they have hundreds of millions of dollars going into Lebanon, the Hezbollah, or whatever, and the Israelis are tracking that. So they're supporting the war in Syria. They're using this cash all over the world to implement their terrorist policies and to fight the U.S. on every front.
Oh, boy.
Jeez Louise. Okay, on that happy note, I'm sorry. Take our last celebration of capitalism. We'll come back and finish up with you guys till the top of the hour. Can't celebrate too much capitalism, especially when we're talking about Iran.
Yeah.
Bummer. You have anything funny for us, Bob? Oh, good. Bob's got something funny, so we don't have to eat blood pressure medication on the break. We'll be right back. You're listening to We the People Radio.
When the world is on your shoulder, gotta straighten up your act and boogie down. If you can't hang with the feeling, then there ain't no room for you in this part of town. Cause we're the party people night and day. Living crazy, that's the only way. So tonight, gotta leave the 9-to-5 up on the shelf and just enjoy yourself. Let the medicine, the music get to you. Life ain't so bad at all.
You live it off the wall.
Life ain't so bad.
Political correctness has gone wild. That's us.
No borders.
Yeah. If it is. We only ever hear the beginning of the song. I guess the rest is fun too. All right, fellas, on that happy note.
That was humor circa 1980, back in the day.
Back in the day when we could joke about things like that.
Yep.
So we know you guys probably aren't allowed to laugh, so we'll laugh for you.
I have to give President Trump a ton of credit because he's dealing with, he must be in the national security room talking to everybody all the time with everything going on.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, we had the hurricanes, we had the forest fires, we have the Afghanistan situation, the Iraq situation, the missiles flying over Japan. I mean, there's not a time for him to rest. And we're dealing also with, you know, some of the crisis we still feel is, you know, predominant in Iraq itself. We're dealing with the Assyrian Christians, too. So there's a lot of stuff going on here that has to be addressed, and people's attention is being swayed, and I guess they're being, I would call it psychologically numb. There's so much going on. There's so much brutality. You go in Las Vegas, and you just, there's too much to deal with for most people.
You know, if you listen to the media, NBC, ABC, those kind of stations, they go, President Trump is doing nothing. He's not accomplishing anything. And then you turn around and look at everything he's doing a tremendous amount of work. And so, he campaigned on what he wanted, and he's doing it. Republicans got to get on board. We got to get their political appointees in to help him. And again, if Mitch McConnell can do his job, then I'd like to see him in a rocking chair at a retirement home in Kentucky.
It's like they're saying he's too focused on the National Football League. Like, no, he's got everybody else focused on the National Football League while he's doing all this other stuff and reworking Obamacare.
Yeah, absolutely.
Not a bad strategy.
And doing the tax reform, too. I mean, he's pushing everything he said. And we have to have our side of the hill, you know, the Republicans, stand up and be counted. And so far they haven't shown that they had the wherewithal. And that's what's embarrassing to me, because President Trump gets elected and they were on his bootstraps, basically. And then he's asking him to do things, and they're being the old establishment kind of thinkers and going so slow, and then they want to do their own thing. And that's not, if you throw the Democrats in there, Democrats are fully organized and they're doing what they want to do. I mean, they're so much better organized than the Republican Party and getting things done.
Yeah, which is
in,
crazy.
In that way. And it's embarrassing to me, you know. And
it, it is, because their ideas are dopey.
All the people that relied on their health care, and we knew Obamacare failed. Everybody says replace and repeal. Well, it hasn't been done. That's embarrassing in a lot of different ways.
And they can't see that. That's something I really find interesting is you look at the colossal failure of Obamacare, and they still stand behind it.
Well, the people who are standing behind it, though, I mean, I'm going to reiterate just from a work standpoint, because I talk to so many people about Obamacare, and the people who love it are not on it.
Right.
I mean, I might have 1% of the people I come in contact with on a daily basis in the phone and in public, you know, people that are adamant, got to keep Obamacare. Oh, really? Is that how you get your coverage? Oh, no, I'm on Medicare. Or, no, I work for the government, so I'm on some government insurance. And it's like, well,
that's
pretty common. So I'm sorry
to get
that.
It's not a bad deal if you're getting all of the government subsidies and only paying $100 a month
for it.
That's
right. Everyone else is.
As soon as you start making any money yourself, you get hit with the tax bill.
Yeah, the bullet comes.
And the subsidies are gone.
We had a guy last week. His tax bill is $18,900 for his Obamacare subsidy adjustment. It's like, oh, that'll work. Chuck,
President Trump even told Congress he wants them to get off of their special plan and get on Obamacare.
Well, we are on Obamacare. Members of Congress and their staff, I mean, I don't talk about my job on this because I don't do this for work, but full disclosure, I'm on the D.C. exchange. So my network providers are in Virginia, Maryland, and Washington, D.C.,
yep.
So anybody who thinks we have some, you know, there's some like different thing, but instead of paying $2,000, I pay like $850 or something, which is still suckier than when we had to buy our own insurance as self-employed people before, Bill and I.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway,
all the independent contractors and small businesses are dying and killed.
Oh yeah, it's just sucking the wind out of them.
Country here.
Hey, tell us, go back to Iran just so we don't leave that just hanging. We got like two minutes or three minutes. If they pull out of this deal, you know, they always make it sound like the world's coming to an end. Honestly,
well, no, it's more than what. This is just part of what's going on. They have so many different strategy and tactical laws running through the National Security Council at the UN. This is part of it. This is our part in how we want to affect change. You see what I mean?
Yeah,
there's
absolutely
other things you can do, but this is the way our Congress can act if you recertify. And that's what Chuck is talking about. Every 90 days we recertify, so get the Senate to act. Senate does this, you know, in terms of foreign policy. The House doesn't do this. So if the Senate acts in accord with what the President wishes, then we can maybe institute some more changes there. And from my personal national security point of view, I want to make sure those inspections are correct. You know, our intelligence on the ground is not good. So,
all right. And then, so Chuck, since it's like kind of a little bit quiet in there. It's just hard to hear you, so you get talked over a lot. What do you have?
We would be better off if we scrap the Iran deal and renegotiated the whole thing.
Okay.
You know, because we need more sanctions. I mean, Obama didn't put any sanctions. He didn't do anything. And so we need more sanctions on them. We need the inspectors on the ground, you know, because they are doing ballistic missiles. They're doing the nuclear tasks and everything else behind the scenes, coordinated with North Korea. So, you know, they're going to have nuclear weapons sooner under this deal than they ever would. But under Trump, the Iranians know that he is serious, and they know that he will cancel this thing, and so we need to keep the pressure up on them. You know, two other issues that really nobody talks about is Mueller. You know, his whole special investigation was based on fake news, and you know, he's all over the map. And he's not even looking at the Russians. He's looking at Trump and other things. And so, because it's nothing there. Then the other big thing is Louie Gohmert is doing, Congressman Louie Gohmert is doing investigation now on Desi Raman Schultz, IT guy, who stole all kinds of information. He was in Pakistan. He put, you know, his whole family.
The Awan brothers.
She allowed him to put his family on different member staff. And she told these other congressmen and women, they're going to be on there, and you're going to pay them what I tell you to do. And, you know, they've made millions and millions of dollars.
Six million, to be exact.
The investigation is not going away.
No, hey, we haven't heard the last of that.
You guys, we totally appreciate having you on. And you know what? I would love to do a whole show on the Awan brothers and that whole thing and unpack that for people. Because it has been an amazing, amazing story to follow.
Well, thanks for coming on, guys. We really
appreciate
it.
Thanks a million. We're going to do this again.
I wrote an article and gave it to the White House back in January of 17 on the Awan brothers.
Oh, that's fantastic. Oh, let's do a show on that. That would be magical. Dear God, that's my favorite story.
Covering the cybersecurity side of it, and it's an atrocity.
Oh, okay.
And they had access to
I'm emailing you.
That's a whole...
Get your calendars out. We're going to email here during the news.
Yes, we specialize in atrocities.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you very much. Have a great day.
Thank you.
Thanks, guys.
Three cheers for Security Solutions Technology. Bruce and Chuck, we love these guys. They're full of information. We will be right back. We're going to chat with Ryan Morrow about Trump's UN speech and what it does to the Islamist ideology. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. Good afternoon, and welcome to the second hour of We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
And I'm Bob Martin.
Bob, just so you know, Bob is where all the good music comes from. And if you missed the first hour, you should catch it on the archive because the music was super fun. The information was fabulous. We talked with some guys that are a part of the Trump transition team with national security and border security in specific. And
totally not enough time.
Totally not enough time. But they do have a lot of information because they all do. They also do IT cybersecurity stuff, IT consulting and cybersecurity. And they have a lot of information about the Awan brothers, the Pakistani brothers who worked for Debbie Wasserman Schultz and 79 other members of the House. And if you haven't been following that story, their last name is spelled A-W-A-N. I would go to the Daily Caller and look up A-W-A-N and begin reading the stories because it is awesome.
Yeah. If you go to school and get a little degree in IT, you can get a job anywhere.
No, you can work at McDonald's and do that.
And there's do just, that.
It'll blow your mind. Yeah. When we do that show, I do hope everyone tunes in. It's really worth its weight in gold. However, this hour, we have Ryan Morrow with us from, he is the Clarion Project's Shulman Fellow. I do not know what that means. He's going to have to tell us about that. He's also a national security analyst. I kind of get what that's for. But and so I'll just read you the little beginning here that brought him to us. President Trump's speech at the UN is being rightly praised, with some even saying it's his best speech as commander-in-chief so far. I'll leave the rest and the reasoning behind on that. And I also posted Ryan's article on the Clarion Project. It's on our website, wethepeopleradio.us. So, with that minor introduction, hi, Ryan.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Thanks for coming on. It's always nice. You know, it's a lot of times people don't catch all of these things that are printed out there, and it's always nice to hear from the person who wrote it and who had the idea. So,
yeah. Well, what can I say? I'm obsessed with this topic of Islamic extremism and all the issues that intersect with it. And that's what I do full-time for the Clarion Project. So the title of Shulman Fellow is basically to cover not just the analytical work I do in terms of media and what you see on the website with the articles I write, but also the behind-the-scenes stuff that I do. It's a reference to things like advising policymakers, government agencies, and doing basically intelligence distribution, where through different sources I have and different methods, we get information on different extremist threats, and then we get it to the law enforcement agencies that are just overwhelmed with information. information. And so, believe it or not, civilians outside the government can do a lot if they know what they're doing, or they just happen to be in the right spot at the right moment and see something and then report it.
That's awesome. And so tell people a little give people a snapshot. The Clarion Project does what?
We've been around since 2006, 2007, before I joined, and we came out with these documentaries that got a lot of attention, so that's what the organization is most known for. The first documentary was Obsession, which aired on CNN and Fox, and was mailed across the country, millions and millions of copies, and it was all about Islamic extremism as told through what appears on Middle Eastern television, so it was mostly just clips explaining the different issues and what this ideology is and how it operates using the radical cleric's own words. So it was really compelling and groundbreaking at that time. And then since then, we've come out with other films like The Third Jihad, which is narrated by a moderate Muslim activist, Zudi Jasser, who is frequently in the media. Iranium about Iran. Honor Diaries about the persecution of women in the Muslim world, and Faith Keepers, which is about the persecution of Christians and other minorities.
Nice. Well, if people look through our archives, we've done a bunch of shows on that to the point where I'm sure we're probably on some hater list.
Someplace. We got to be on a hit list somewhere.
So yes, we should probably have you back several times.
We make the Southern Poverty Law Center list yet?
We aren't on the Southern Poverty Law Center list yet, but you know we're trying.
We're rookies.
Seeing if we can get up there.
Yeah.
It's not that hard these days, so be hopeful because they're just throwing everyone on that list. It's amazing. It's like half the country are apparently Nazis, KKK members.
Well,
and
crap, maybe we are
leaders.
On there.
Hey, we got to double check.
I'm just joking. I never actually did look. We probably are because a friend of mine I found out is like. Person number six or something. It's like, oh, wow.
There's somebody.
You're killing it.
So let's unpack this this speech, President Trump's UN speech.
Because you either heard it was great or you heard that it was just, you know, humiliating and just embarrassed America and all that.
Well,
so.
All the talk was, this is going to be the speech that just shows him as the buffoon he is. And it turned out
that it was really good.
It was just the opposite.
Sure. Well, there have been two really good speeches by Trump recently, which was the first was the UN speech, which I think in terms of a speech on international affairs beats anything since Reagan. Maybe not in delivery because it's Trump, but you have to print it. If you print it out and you read it, it's really amazing. And so I've read it more than I've watched it. And then you had the speech about Iran. But one of the things that happens here, especially in cable news, is that the booking strategy for these speeches is a lot of the segments is they'll bring on a Republican political strategist, like that's their job, and the Democratic political strategist, and their job is to just argue about it. And so just by nature of that process, you already have people that are going off of talking points and whose job it is to play that role. Rather than bringing on immediately after just objective analysts that aren't playing that game. And so that's why no matter what Trump or even Obama did, you get these kind of predictable criticisms no matter what. But the UN speech was very different from other speeches I've seen. And if you understand the language of third world dictators in the Middle East, it hit most of the right points. The only criticism that I had was that the Sunni Islamists, like Saudi Arabia and Qatar, really seem to get off the hook, but there's a strategic consideration there, which is that we want to ally with them against Iran. And I don't agree with that logic. I think we can do a bunch of things all at once, but that's probably the consideration behind Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and Turkey not being held accountable by Trump in the speech. But when it came to talking about Iran and North Korea and Venezuela and some of these other issues, it was really amazing to see, and I think in my article I wrote of, I think it was at least 10 lines that I thought were just mind-blowing in how articulate and nuanced they were, thanks to speechwriters and advisors, granted, but still they were in there. The president still authorizes what goes in there at the end of the day.
Sure. And he had the guts to say it. I mean, that's, you know, I think the overwhelming view was he's going to isolate us from everybody with this speech, and that didn't really happen, did it?
No, that's because other countries aren't as sensitive and dramatic as we are. We act right. Like some undiplomatic language and some insulting is going to cause another country to become so hurt that they're going to stop thinking about their own interests and what's best for their country, and it's going to isolate us. It doesn't work that way.
Or they're just going to have a tantrum and start a war with us because somebody was mean to them.
Because we microaggressed them.
Yeah, exactly.
We're projecting that sensitivity, that buffoonery that's going on in American culture onto other places. And it's just not that way. Like, when you hear Trump talking about the Iran deal and European countries who are making a lot of money off that deal going ballistic and saying, oh, this is so undiplomatic. Well, guess what? It doesn't actually matter, because at the end of the day, if you have to choose between the U.S. or Iran to invest in, you're going to go with the U.S.
Yeah.
And up until that point, especially if you're a businessman, you're going to be screaming because you want to invest in both and make as much money as possible. And so sometimes a lot of the song and dance that you see is very predictable from these governments and from leaders that are condemning something that the United States does, flipping out over something that Trump does, and those that think it matters are just exaggerating it, because at the end of the day, it doesn't change the calculation of the country that you're talking about.
No, and I think that's a really good point. What's in the best interest of the country? You know, everybody was up in arms over the conversations he was having with Canada, like Canada was going to turn their back on us. You know what? I don't think there's a lot of countries out there that are going to run the other way from the United States. I mean, they know what's good for them. They may not like the new rules, but they're still going to hang with the United States, invest with the United States, because it's in their best interest. I mean, that's bottom line.
Yeah, I think so, and I think being tough in order to get that to set those rules for countries like North Korea and Iran and frankly, even the UN and international dynamics as a whole, just that posture is very positive. And while you're also hearing screaming and condemnations coming from around the world, you are seeing certain things happen, like China becoming more cooperative with North Korea, Pakistan becoming a little bit more cooperative. Iran just said that they're willing to negotiate over their ballistic missile program. So behind the panic that you see that gets the TV news segments, that dominates the headlines, because you can take a pithy quote and make it into a good news story, if you look at actual behavior, you see that panic that Trump causes actually results in changes of behavior. And so in many cases it works. In many cases it doesn't when you're impulsive, but the stuff that people are complaining about, it's the stuff that actually seems to work. And it's really interesting to see that dynamic play out. One concern I do have is there is a prevailing perception, particularly within the Middle East, that the U.S. is still not a reliable friend, and that we're still not willing to shake up the status quo in a substantive way. And the best example of that, I think, it would be the Muslim Brotherhood, which is like the biggest radical Islamic movement across the world, where a lot of our friends that are combating them expected Trump to call them a terrorist group and to take action against them, and that hasn't happened. In Iraq and Syria, our best allies are the Kurds, and yet, just like under Obama, we are still kissing the feet of the dictator of Turkey and not backing the Kurds. And so there is a lot of hope among friends of ours in the region, but I am seeing a simmering disappointment and a belief that, you know what, maybe it doesn't matter who's president of the United States. Maybe the U.S. is just kind of controlled by someone behind the scenes, and the president is just a puppet. And that's kind of the perception, because you don't see these big changes from administration to administration. So I hope Trump does, you know, starts thinking about how to shake up the region and starts thinking about matching that rhetoric with some really dynamic action.
I think It's just nice that there's a massive shift from the Obama era, you know, that all that nicey-nice and all the bowing and stuff. I think most people were just so frustrated with that. It's very very refreshing to hear somebody speak plainly. It's nice. So we have to take a really swift break. Or don't we? Mm-hmm. Do we? I didn't wait till I got the high sign. There, I got the high sign. We'll take a really quick break. We're going to come back with our guest, Ryan Morrow, from the Clarion Project. And I'm sure we'll extend beyond the UN speech, but we'll go wherever Ryan takes us because he's a smart guy and has tons of information. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
Give a damn's busted. Oh, baby, come on. Let me take you where the action is. It's so neat to meet your baby where the action is. In every little town across the USA, there's a spot where the
I like it.
Every day.
That's where Ryan lives, where all the action is. Is he on radio silence?
No, he's here.
Are you ignoring us, Ryan?
No, I didn't want to laugh into the phone and then interrupt the music.
That's okay, that's the goofing off portion. That's our cover. See, that's how we get to talk about all these serious, depressing issues without, you know, actually causing mental health problems for our audience.
Yeah, I've learned in my public presentations, especially like speaking engagements where it goes on for like 45 minutes or an hour, that I have to always end on with basically a list of like 20 positive things that are happening. Otherwise, it's just so dreary and it's just,
yeah.
You know, people don't like it, even if they're interested in the topic. I mean, how much of it can you handle?
Exactly. That's exactly it. So we do like to talk about a lot of topics that are sometimes unsolvable. I mean, not everything has a, you know, a bow at the end, but it doesn't mean we have to be, you know, nasty while we do it.
No, you need a twisted sense of humor.
Yep.
That not everybody's going to understand as a coping mechanism, and just know that's going to come with the territory when you study this stuff, and you've got to... honestly, I mean, the majority of people that study this stuff, by the time they get to their mid-50s, and I've seen this happen to people, they really start losing their minds.
And really?
Hey, wait a minute, I'm 56. What are you saying?
But are you studying, like, terrorism all the time?
No, thank God.
Negative stuff? Or, like, even just people that are studying politics from an angle of, like, always complaining? And if you don't make that daily commitment of finding something funny or finding some silver lining in all of this, it's going to do damage to your psyche. And I'm sure that that's damaging the psyche of the country as a whole just because you have a 24/7 news cycle now. And I don't know what those effects are, but I'm sure there's some effects going on that we're not measuring.
I can see it in their driving.
Right.
I think if we really want to spot it in its most raw form, we just go out on the roadway. And just watch how people act. It's like,
that's actually kind of a fair way of looking at it, because it's not going to come out in this way where someone says, "How are you?" You're going to be like, "Oh, I'm so upset over Iran and Burma, North." It's like that's just not how it happens.
That's right.
It's going to come out in these like in these more subtle ways where there's a slight frustration, then you flip out over it.
Yeah.
So road rage actually is a pretty good way. I think that's a fair correlation.
They're not going to give you the finger in church, but they might run you over in the parking lot.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's always a lot of that. It's always been true, but I think it's more true now. And I do think, being someone in my mid-50s, that I was talking to someone about that the other day. I said, hey, you know, you're old like I am. Remember back in the day when you went home from work and, like, then work was over because it was at work and it couldn't find you? Like, if you were out mowing the grass or you were, you know, walking your dog or doing something, your work couldn't get a hold of you because there was no cell phone. There was a phone on the wall in your kitchen, and we didn't even have call waiting. for a long time when my kids were little. There was no call waiting.
Shoot, we had a party line.
Yeah. It's like, you know, you can't be on the phone because my husband at that time was a truck driver and he was waiting to be dispatched. So no one could use the phone at night because the dispatcher might call. And I just laugh. Now, you know, the other night the phone rang at like 10:30 and Bill goes, "Doesn't anybody at your work ever sleep?"
Like, those are the good old days.
I'm like, no, not really. But it's true, though.
No.
You know,
constant communication.
I was looking at something someone made for an auction last night up at in our congressional district here. And someone had made some really cool auction items. And the one lady goes, "I used to make things like that." And I was like, "Gee, so did I." But then they invented email. And it, like, ruined my life.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. And what the problem I have is that the 9-to-5 thing doesn't work for me because my brain just doesn't always hyper-focus like it needs to for, like, brain-intensive work.
Yep.
So 9-to-5 jobs don't really work with my personality.
They don't work with my sleep habits and my fun either.
What's that?
Yeah, they don't work with my sleep habits, my fun, my interest level. I'm not always interested at 9 o'clock.
Mm. Yeah, all right, so then you ditch the 9-to-5 thing, but now you're 24/7.
Yep.
Right.
Yep.
And those are the two choices you have for your career and lifestyle, and both are terrible.
It's kind of funny, though, if you do things that you really like, the bad part is it integrates into your life because then you're doing it all the time. But the nice part is you don't resent it. It isn't like, oh, it's work calling.
Your friends and family do.
Well, you just cut back on them. You got to cut back on them.
That's what they make email for.
I can remember like maybe 10 or 15 like really awesome times I had with my friends since the age of 21.
Yeah, I only really have friends with people I work with. You got to just cut back on the other people. They're just kind of, you know, they're just
a lot of work.
Yeah, it's hard to carry them along. You know, there's nothing to talk about either. Oh my gosh.
Yeah, that's true. You do kind of lose the ability to talk to them. You just grow apart, you know, when you deal with, like, if you go into a career that you like, so you start getting really absorbed in it and you kind of become an expert on it, it just inhibits your ability to talk to other people about, like, the Kardashians and things like that.
Dancing with the Stars.
You know, like, all these people are mentioning all these actresses and movies that I've never watched and haven't heard of. And I remember it wasn't that long ago. I used to know every movie that came out. And I was like, man, I think I'm falling down the black hole that everyone in my field does.
But
ending up there.
Isn't it funny, though, that when you do talk to people outside of your line of work and they do mention things like that, or even professional sports, which is something I've just never really had an interest in, I just think, gosh, how much time do you waste in your life that you're never going to get back, worrying about people you're never going to meet, and watching, you know, pro teams that...
And yet, when you talk to them about politics, they're like...
They're totally lost.
They have no idea who any of the people are. Yeah, the secretary of the what?
Yeah.
What do they do?
They know everything.
But, oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
It's pretty funny.
They all have an
opinion.
They've
got all the answers. They won't ask you a question. They'll give you an answer, though.
Yeah,
that's a great point. Yeah, but I'm always amazed by what people do spend their time.
And they all think we're crazy, of course. They're having the same right now.
They're having the same conversation about us. It's like, you guys need to get a life.
You people need to get out more.
Yeah.
Now, the problem is now not all of them, but a sizable portion of the athletes think we care what they have to say when it comes to politics.
Yeah, and how unfortunate that has been. That's been a real, that's called a CLM, actually. I learned about that a long time ago. It's a career-limiting move.
Yes.
I've actually never heard that.
Yes,
well,
yes.
With these football players, though, when I retire, I'm probably going to become a violent old man. Where it doesn't matter if I get a criminal record, there's a good chance I'm going to find, like, Colin Kaepernick and just, like, slap him.
my mom, I've said this before, but honestly, my mom's very, very nice, really. She's way nicer than any of her kids, actually. But we were at a ball game years ago, and this guy would not take his hat off during the national anthem. My mom went berserk. She literally reached over other people and smacked this guy in the back of the head. And she was like, "Cat, quick, too." It's like, that was usually my dad's
take
signature
off your
move.
Hat, sonny.
It was, and the guy like whipped around, and my mom's like, "Take your hat off." And I thought, who was that? Like, that was as close to possession as anyone in my family's ever been. That was just like, she was somebody else. But you look at that now, honestly, you'd probably be up for assault. We don't take my mom out in public anymore, so we've solved that problem. At least to nothing. We don't take her to anything patriotic. No sporting events of any kind.
Yeah, well, if you want to do something patriotic, you can't go to a sporting event now, because now it's all the game of, like, oh, who's gonna stand, who's not. It's, oh, God. Something's going on with our culture. It's just, like, where I think part of it, again, is that 24/7 news cycle where it's, like, you used to have time off from it, everyone, but now you go onto, like, Facebook to look at cat pictures, and you have news headlines, like, over on the right-hand side. So people are getting overly emotional about things because you're just getting reminded of it all the time. And if you don't have the type of brain that is real analytical and looks at that from a research perspective, like, I just love the political science of it all.
I do, too.
I can remove myself from the emotion.
Yeah.
Then you are going to get, like, real crazy, and you also are going to get arrogant because you're like, oh, I see these headlines all the time. I'm very educated, without realizing that you're just getting a headline over and over again.
Yeah.
As opposed to a book where each sentence is different.
Well, how about my favorite Facebook ones are the ones where people write these long manifestos about how they're breaking up with their friends because they can no longer tolerate, you know, the intolerance of the tolerating of the intolerance. It just goes on and on, and you're like...
And the microaggressions.
It's like, hey, wait a minute. I think that guy broke up with all his friends like a month ago. He's doing it again. Slowly whittling them out, like, one little herd at a time. It's kind of sad, actually.
Yeah, I saw that on Facebook. A lot of people saying, oh, just delete me if you voted for Trump.
Yes.
And I've seen so less people, you know, saying the same thing about Hillary or Obama, and I'm like, what type of life do you lead? And the projection there is something, it's just a classic example for psychology students to study, where the example I used to give, and I now give the one you just mentioned, but the other example I used to give would be like on a dating website, and if a woman puts, I really hate drama, no drama, I hate drama, the fact that she has to say that in her profile means
Yippers.
That she is the source of drama.
Yes, that means she has a lot of drama.
It surrounds her.
And causes a lot of drama because she likes drama.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's funny, and there are a lot of men who don't really actually see through that, which is sort of humorous.
I don't get it.
Until they get divorced, and it's not that humorous anymore. But,
yeah.
Well, yeah, sorry, we just sort of burned through that little bit of time frame. We had this little off-air, on-air talk.
Yeah, we don't like drama either.
No, we don't like drama either. All right, we're going to take a quick break and come right back with Ryan. We're going to talk about something important when we come back. Mostly, I'm not going to ask any questions. Ryan, you just launch in and go to something important we need to know, okay?
All right.
So I don't get you off track and we start talking about nothing. That was like a Seinfeld episode we just had.
It was.
Yeah. Except you're listening to We the People. Join us online. WeThePeopleRadio.us. Where Seinfeld just happens.
A whole segment about nothing?
Okay. Exactly.
You're talking, it all sounds fair. You promise your love, how much you care. I'm still listening, but still unsure.
She doesn't like drama. I can tell by the sound of her voice.
Just hold me.
Yeah. Love talking over the music. It's bad. People probably don't like it.
I like
if you don't
song.
Like it, you could email us. I'm just not going to tell you where. We're back with Ryan Morrow. All right, hit it, Ryan. What's important?
I think all the news right now is focusing on the Iran deal, and Trump decertifying it, which again is one of those things that it's significant because of the pressure it's putting on Iran and the countries that trade with Iran, but it's not. If people are making it sound like that means he's just pulled out of the nuclear deal with Iran, that the U.S. is going rogue, and that's not what's happening because the deal is so complicated in how it was set up and approved that they don't understand what's happening. There are actually two sets of standards in regards to how the U.S. is handling the nuclear issue with Iran, which is the first standard is whether Iran is in actually complying with the deal itself. Trump says that they're not, cites some relatively minor violations, and then some people argue that those aren't actually violations. Whatever, put that to the side. The second standard is the standard for the U.S. to remain in the deal. There was an agreement between Congress and the president that basically said that Iran's had to meet these other standards, which includes upholding the spirit of the deal, that sanctions would remain in the national security interests of the U.S., that Iran would comply with what was vaguely called related agreements. And by any standard, Iran is not meeting that second set of standards for the U.S. and the presidency and the Congress to have America continue in the deal. So what Trump has basically said was is that Iran is not meeting that second standard, and now it is up to Congress to debate whether we stick with the deal and also how we can improve it. So we may end up improving it, we may end up withdrawing from it, but at least now it begins that process of addressing the weaknesses in the deal and maximizing pressure on Iran and those that trade with the regime there.
Okay, well, that makes sense. So they get to keep the money. Right now they're inspecting themselves. So let's say we did nothing. What does that do? Where is that good or bad? I mean, it seems bad, but...
Well, we can't really go to a spot where we do nothing because Trump just ordered the Treasury Department to treat the entire Iranian Revolutionary Guards Corps as a terrorist group, which is the wing of the regime that keeps it in power and controls at least a third of the Iranian economy. So that's a big deal. That makes it very difficult for countries to trade with Iran because you don't know what's a front organization for the Revolutionary Guards. You don't know if the construction company, which the Revolutionary Guards is really involved in, you don't know if this construction company that sounds completely separate and independent is actually a front for them. And so why would you do business with them when you could get sanctioned for it, they could get sanctioned, the whole thing could collapse. So we are in a new situation now. The Europeans are complaining, but that's because top business executives that are connected to the top politicians have been going back and forth from Europe to Iran and striking up these contracts to make lots and lots of blood money. So we're in a new situation now. Iran's already saying that they're willing to negotiate over their ballistic missile program, which they previously said they would not be. So Iran is scared. Behind their bluster and their shouts of death to America, you're seeing some signs of fear.
That's kind of great. So why? What's the motivation on the left? Really, for besides the fact that, you know, everything Trump says is bad, blah, 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 same stuff. But why would they want to keep the deal in place the way it is?
They have a few different arguments. The chief one saying that you risk compelling Iran to just run full force towards a nuclear weapon because the sites that are overt that they have declared, all of them they hit at one point, but they declared after they were found. There are inspections there. The activity at those sites is being limited, whereas before it was not limited. And so they say, well, this is at least with the overt signs of the program and the inspections that could detect covert activity, it's keeping it in a box, even though the Iranian regime is going to be getting rich over time and this strengthens Iran. It's worth keeping them in that box. Otherwise, if they start dashing towards a nuclear weapon, you might have to take military action. You get yourself into a war. So there's some reasonable logic behind that. And so they say something is better than nothing, and this is a big something. And then when it comes to the issue of, well, what about, aren't you strengthening the Iranian regime? There's a flawed argument, but this is the common argument, that the trade with the outside world will moderate the regime, that it will lead to an opening, and then that will lead to it maximizes the chance for an evolution within the regime, so the regime changes or it falls over time.
Hmm. But, you know, you say a run towards nuclear development. If they're self-inspecting, how do we know they're not already doing that?
Well, some of their sites are inspected by the inspectors, by the IAEA, but then anything that they consider to be a military site, specifically it's one site at Parchin that's been involved in developing nuclear warheads, they are self-inspected, but they have, like, cameras on the outside, and Iran could hide stuff there, but there's enough surveillance that some activity would be detected that we could inquire about. I still don't think it's enough, but that's the argument. Now the question is, what if Iran has covert sites? The Israelis say that they do have information about covert sites that the IAEA, the UN, is not requesting access to. The UN saying that the evidence is not enough. You have Iranian opposition groups who collect intelligence with a very good track record within Iran, saying that they know of specific hidden nuclear sites. They even provided the coordinates on the internet and published Google pictures to show where the tunnel construction was happening. So this current situation, the risk is that if we go along with the deal, you're going to have an Iranian regime that has the money and the means to already covertly pursue a nuclear weapon, but then when they really want to start developing a nuclear bomb, they'll have such a large infrastructure that they quickly get an arsenal. So it won't be about dashing towards a single nuclear bomb. It'll be about flipping the switch, and then all of a sudden they have dozens of nuclear weapons.
Okay. So is that...
And who is selling them uranium? We have a question in the chat room. It's actually people in the chat room.
Well, they're mining it themselves now.
Oh.
So they have their own uranium mines, which they've been expanding.
I did not know that.
Yeah.
God, isn't that fantastic?
They're expanding that, and then also they were importing some from Venezuela and shopping around for some in Africa because there was a shortage at one point, but they're addressing that shortage by expanding their own mines.
And Venezuela is so well organized right now, I'm sure that's got real tight controls on that.
Yeah, there's also no information indicating that uranium's going there right now, but there's been talk in the past. And Venezuela, despite being a Marxist dictatorship over there, which you would assume would be atheist and hates radical Islam, but they are actually allied with Iran. So the Iranian Revolutionary Guards Corps, the terrorist wing of the regime, is operating there. There's indications that Hezbollah is there. So it's actually a quite tight alliance, just like you see with Iran and North Korea, even though there's no compatibility between their ideologies except for the fact that they hate America and they hate the Jews.
Yeah, well, at least they're organized. They always hate all the guys who like each other. When we come back, if you don't mind, kind of in the last part of this, before we all have to go back and do boring things in our life again and stop goofing off on the radio, somebody in the chat room said, this is like being on a party line with our little random segment there in the middle. I would like you to speak a little bit about why, going back to discussing the whole Islamism, you know, why bringing that up again in that speech was so important. I mean, I've got a million opinions on that, but I'd like to know what you see there and what that bodes for us, since obviously the last 8 years, you know, or the previous 8 years, we didn't talk about that at all for any reason. Very unfortunate. We're going to be right back with Ryan Morrow from the Clarion Project. You are listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeople.us. Sorry.
Come back.
Wethepeopleradio.us. Sorry, I got it.
That's better.
Chat talking, you really know about all
kind of open for some Weird Al Yankovic. I thought we were due. We don't want Ryan to get the wrong impression of us. All right, Ryan.
What was I thinking?
Yeah, what were you thinking? Okay, so throwing down a little bit on the Islamism and all that, what does that do for us? Because I know other people are gasping, oh, how dare he bring that up. But why do you think that's a good thing?
Well, basically, the idea is when you identify the enemy as Islamism or radical Islam, whatever it is, some type of Islamic vernacular,
right?
You force the Muslim world to debate what that is. And then as they take a stand on what that is and whether they oppose it, you can find your true ally. So, for example, the real secular democratic activists in the Muslim world, people who are privately devout Muslim but they don't want to implement their faith as a political system, they have no problem with terms like radical Islam, jihadist, or Islamism, whatever you want to call it, because that doesn't threaten them. Those that then get really offended by it usually tend to have connections to groups like the Muslim Brotherhood. They're ones that may not be so radical as to do something like Al-Qaeda and ISIS does, but they are still in that category. They're like Hamas. They still want to implement a theocracy, Sharia law. So it's very difficult to tell friend from foe when you don't have that paradigm of what you're going after. And so we have to identify the enemy as being theocratic in nature, as ideological in nature, so that we can separate them and don't make mistakes like we've done in the past where we say, well, Iran is moderate compared to Al-Qaeda, so we should ally with them. Or the Muslim Brotherhood is moderate compared to Al-Qaeda, so we should ally with them, which has been the strategy in many ways since 9/11, to focus singularly on groups like Al-Qaeda and ISIS and view others as being non-issues or even being friends.
And do you think that's been effective?
It's only effective on the battlefield, I would say, when you're in a situation where if the two forces are actually shooting at each other and then you have American boots or American allies in the area, then it makes sense that you want those two forces to fight each other. But that usually isn't what happens. It's very complicated where, for example, Iran and Al-Qaeda might be on opposite sides in Syria, but then you'll find out that bin Laden is saying that the main artery of his organization is through Iran. The chief of Al-Qaeda, Ayman al-Zawahiri, might be in Iran right now. And so these folks, these jihadists that you think, because of their differences with each other, where they even kill each other, to think that there can be some type of meaningful temporary alliance with one jihadist against another is just going to backfire, because they can cooperate and kill each other at the same time, and in their psychology, that's consistent.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's been that way for 1,000 years.
Yeah, it goes back to the founding of Islam, where you did have people being conquered, and you did have the values of the time being enshrined into religious rulings that then people say you can't budge from. Luckily, there's an increasing number of Muslims that are out there that are saying, well, this obviously isn't working. It's obviously not what God intended, so we need to start looking at things differently, discarding certain things, maybe not emulating the Prophet Muhammad in every single circumstance, because, after all, we drive cars, not camels. And so you're seeing changes happening in the Muslim world beneath the surface that isn't going to be a top headline, but you are seeing these voices increase, and it's encouraging. You've seen them lose elections in places like Tunisia and Libya, referring to the radical Islamic forces that once were popular. The Muslim Brotherhood came into power in Egypt and then was kicked out by an alliance of Muslims and Christians coming together. And there are a lot of stories like that that we have to remember when we look at the depressing world that we live in, that there are positive trends here and there are concrete reasons to believe that we're going to be victorious. And I don't think that this has to be a generations-long struggle.
No, probably not. And there's a really large population of Iranian Americans. The organization of Iranian American communities that we've had on the show before, and those guys don't want any part of all the Sharia law and all those sorts of things. That's not where they're headed, and they don't want the religious guys running their country. That's why they left.
Exactly. The Iranian community in the United States and in Europe is exceptionally moderate. There, you'll find many atheists there, many non-practicing Muslims.
Yeah, they're very secular, really. They're very very sensible people, and they're not, you know, kind of a bad word, but they're not lurking, you know. It isn't like pretending to be one thing. They said, hey, we want the Iran of the 70s when, you know, women drove and didn't have to wear, you know, burqas and all that stuff. They would like to go back to their country and see their relatives. But boy, anybody says anything about that now, they're
off with your head.
They're doomed.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's one of the big failures of our strategy since 9/11. I fault both Bush and Obama for that, and even Clinton, because this was the obvious solution even before 9/11, which is that we should have gotten materially behind those Iranian opposition groups that are fighting for that type of thing, because I'd much rather have them fight it than us, which is what's going to end up happening.
Well, and what they tell us all the time is they just want us to leave them alone so they can finish, you know, they want to get the job done, but we keep getting in the way.
Well, they do need our help. If you look at the Cold War, the anti-communist forces did need our help, and it's not always bombing and military stuff. It's just intelligence, propaganda, supplies, money. There's a whole range of creative things that you can do, and if we were able to do it during the Cold War when we didn't have the internet like we do today, then imagine what we could do today with weaker regimes and greater capabilities. If we had a strategy like that and applied it not just to Iran, but North Korea and all these other places, we could really wage an ideological war that would be much cheaper than the military effort.
Oh, absolutely. And speaking of North Korea,
we have 1 minute. Could you please sum up the thing on North Korea?
What do you think is going to happen there, or can you even predict?
The odds are lots and lots of bloodshed. The hope is that North Korea is reacting to internal instability. That's what I assume. The dictator just gave an award to his sister, gave her a new rank. That indicates to me that a lot of these provocations is because the North Korean regime feels that having external conflict is the way it holds on to power.
Hmm.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, so I think so. The positive there would be that means that the regime understands that it's internally weak, and there are reports of them moving people out of the capital, being more vicious. We know that there's a black market in North Korea, so people are getting exposed to Western culture, and those trends are positive. But the question then arises, what do you do when the regime starts going down? What's the regime act like?
Right. How do you feel?
Well, and in honor of our North Korean discussion, we have a special song at the end here. Little Rocket Man there.
Yeah, a Little Rocket Man.
So thanks a lot, Ryan. We really appreciate it. And we want you to come back and play with us on a Sunday afternoon. If you can hang on for 2 seconds, I have a question for you off air when we cut out here. So hang with us for just a second. You've been listening to We the People Radio. You can find us online at wethepeopleradio.us, and we'll have a commercial free archive posted this afternoon. I'll have the full archive posted in about 20 minutes. And we will miss you next week, but please tune in. We have special substitute guests, and we'll be back with you at the end of the month with something fun. Maybe the Awan brothers.
They're substitute hosts.
Oh, substitute hosts. Sorry, the guests are always substitutes. I got that backwards. I was all focused on getting out of my chair and going and asking Ryan a question. Thanks so much for listening.
And I think it's going to be a long, long time. Touchdown brings me round and get to find. I'm not the man they think I am at home. I'm now alone.
This is KCNR Shasta Redding.